With the invulnerability of tanks and the ability to take 10 rounds and still run, they are fearsome, and they are 6 feet of feathered fury. Welcome, folks, to the Great Emu War and the continuation of the life of the officer who had to give the order to open fire. Welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, an Australian military history podcast. This is part two of the life, service, and legacy of Honorary Brigadier General Gwynedd Purvis Wynne Aubrey Meredith, whose 47-year military career is overshadowed by a two-month operation known as the Great Emu War. In part one, I introduce you to Gwynedd Purvis Wynne Aubrey Meredith, a professional soldier that had been a part of Australia's permanent military force essentially since he came of age. With an apparent affinity for artillery, and by the end of the last episode, it was October 1932, and Gwynedd, who for the sake of ease will be referred to going forward as Meredith, had been serving in the Australian Field Artillery for 24 years, and had just been promoted to the rank of Major. He had also been assigned to the position of Officer Commanding, 6th Heavy Battery, Royal Australian Artillery, and Staff Officer for Artillery of the 5th Military District, headquartered in Fremantle, Western Australia. This is when he, Sergeant S. McMurray, and Gunner J. O'Halloran received orders to collect 10,000 rounds of ammunition, 2 Lewis automatic machine guns, and to travel roughly 250 kilometres to Campion, Western Australia, to deal with the persistent threat of emus that in an event that is now known as the Great Emu War. As mentioned in Part 1, following the Great War, with a sudden influx of returned soldiers from across the British Empire, the Australian government handed out parcels of land in regional and rural areas of the country for these soldiers to take up farming in an attempt to improve the economy. However, due to an overall lack of education, poor soil quality, and the onset of the Great Depression in 1929, meant that a lot of these farms were already on the brink of failing, even with the promise of government subsidies to continue farming wheat crops. This is despite plummeting prices, these could do little to improve the situation. This was compounded on the western coast of Australia, where there were calls for Australia's geographically largest state to leave the Commonwealth, something that had been more or less been a recurring issue since Australia became a federated country in 1901, though by 1932 it actually gained some serious momentum. This meant that by October 1932, the situation had become so dire that some of these Western Australian soldier settlers were preparing to harvest that season's wheat crop while simultaneously threatening to withhold it from sale to the government. One thing that none of these farmers had anticipated was due to all the large-scale agricultural work on land that could be only considered of questionable quality and only suitable for livestock and grain, was that clearing large portions of it and damming water courses for irrigation is that it would attract native animals, and in particular, one of the largest flightless birds in the world, in particular, the emu, approximately 20,000 emus to be exact. The emu itself is a native symbol for Australia, it's on our coat of arms, but it's also considered a pest along with the kangaroo, and apparently it also tastes delicious. Traditionally, emus migrated towards the coast to breed in more hospitable coastal environs, but with all the work done on these farms, it actually enticed the emus to change their patterns and settle inland. The emus consumed and spoiled crops, as well as damaging barrier fencing, which left large gaps where rabbits could enter and cause further problems. The farmers of Western Australia relayed their concerns about the emus to Sir George Foster Pearce, one of Western Australia's federal senatorial representatives, who had been visiting Western Australia at the time as part of a federalist movement to dissuade the population from voting in favour of leaving the Commonwealth. When they met with Senator Pearce, who was also serving as Australia's Minister for Defence and had been during the Great War, they stated that the ordinary firearms they were using were useless to stop the emus and requested that the army loan machine guns to the farmers to help destroy the birds. Pearce was understandably unwilling to hand over one of the most deadliest weapons used during the Great War to disgruntled farmers who had every intention of leaving the Commonwealth, and in my own research for this episode, this claim has raised some several red flags with me, because the standard farmer's rifle being used at this time was chambered in .303 caliber, which is exactly the same used by the machine guns used in the Australian arsenal. Pearce, however, mentioned that he'd be willing to dispatch a contingent of military personnel accustomed with the operating of machine guns to assist the farmers, which seemed to placate them. This contingent would be under the command of Major Meredith and be picked from members of the 6th Heavy Battery. The media laughed at them for the absurdity of it all and dubbed it the Great Emu War to make light of the situation. It did give readers a moment of levity during the otherwise grim Great Depression. While the general population thought it was silly to send any troops after birds, the farmers were upset that the government had only sent three to try and solve it. This is the biggest misconception about the Emu War. It's the way it's mentioned. In modern retellings, save for the oversimplified video that brought it to my attention, it's always portrayed as a massive assault staged by the Australian military. It wasn't. It was literally just three men, a pickup truck, two Lewis machine guns, and 10,000 rounds of ammunition. Now, there were veteran farmers who took up arms and assisted them, but only Major Meredith and his two troopers were officially considered part of the operation. And from what I've read, the only reason why Senator Pierce agreed to this was to try and halt the secessionist movement. Whatever was the reason for sending Meredith and his troopers, when they arrived by train in rural Campion, they were met with fanfare and crowds and questions, as the farmers were actually expecting a lot more than just the three men. Rain would delay the initial engagement between the men of the 6th Heavy Battery and the Emus, so it wasn't until the 2nd of November when conditions improved to allow the soldiers to be involved. Whereupon they were deployed with orders to assist the farmers and, according to a newspaper account, had been ordered by Army Headquarters to collect 100 emu skins so that their feathers could be used to make hats for light horsemen. Emu plumes atop of slouch hats are still an iconic image of Australian cavalry. This dates back to the Boer War, but was made famous during the light horse charge at Beersheba during the First World War. On the 5th of November, 50 emus had been sighted by local farmers near the town, and when Meredith ordered the contingents to Lewis machine guns to be set up, it was discovered that the birds were out of range. Local farmers then attempted to flush them into the kill zone, but owing to the unpredictable nature of wild animals, the emus didn't act the way one would expect humans to, and immediately broke up into smaller groups that ran, and which made them difficult to target, and pointed out one of the main reasons why you don't use machine guns to deal with wild animals. Machine guns as a weapons platform are primarily intended to suppress an enemy position, either as an attempt to break up in advance, or to keep a defender's heads down as friendly troops approach from the flanks. When your opponent, however, reacts erratically when exposed to loud noises, the machine gun is far from ideal. Almost because of this, the first burst of automatic fire was ineffective due to the range, and the second burst was reportedly able to kill what the papers called a number of birds. On the same day, a small flock was encountered and perhaps a dozen birds were killed before Meredith and his contingent retired from the evening. After these first engagements, the media had a field day, with reporters acting as if battlefield correspondents during the Great War, applying military terminology and tactics to the animalistic reactions of these flightless birds, in such ways that you would see Rudyard Kipling covering the Crimean War or Charles Bean during the First World War. It would be 2 days later, on the 4th of November, when Meredith would engage the emus again, when he established an ambush at a nearby dam, where more than 1,000 emus had been spotted on the way. This time, however, the gunners waited until the birds were closer before opening fire. However, mechanical issues, namely one of the guns jammed, meant that only 12 birds were killed before they scattered, and none more would be seen that day. Meredith and his contingent would have limited success for the days that followed as they moved south in search for more emus. 4 days into the expedition, Meredith noted that each pack of emus seemed to have their own leader now, a black-plumed bird which stands fully 6 foot tall and keeps watch while his mates carry out their work of destruction and warns them of our approach. At one stage, in an attempt to get more mobile, Meredith ordered one of the Lewis guns mounted to the back of a truck. However, this was futile, as the trucks at the time had a hard time keeping up with emus and lacked proper roads and suspension, which meant the gunner couldn't fire any shots even if he did get range. By the 8th of November, 6 days into the first engagement, 2,500 rounds of ammunition had been fired, but Meredith and his men had little to show for it. With official counts varying wildly from between 50 and 500 emus killed, either way, the expenditure per bird was so great that it became a topic of fierce debate in the halls of federal parliament, where Senator Pierce was grilled by his federal opposition opponents on issues relating to the cost of the whole affair and the apparent lack of success. Officially, the military didn't have a stance on whether or not this was a success or a failure, and while the West Australian government wanted a continuance in the operation, which is surprising considering they were the ones bankrolling it out of their own coffers, on the 8th of November, Meredith and his contingent and guns were sent back to Fremantle. In Meredith's official report, he noted that none of his men suffered any casualties. It would seem that this whole affair did little to tarnish the image of Major Meredith, and once back in the cities, he resumed the duties of a staff officer. He organized fundraisers, balls, and trivia competitions to help support the soldiers and their families through the Great Depression, and oversaw official duties such as military funerals and weddings. When asked about the operation, Meredith stated that if we had a military division with the bullet-carrying capacity of these birds, it would face any army in the world. They can face machine guns with the invulnerability of tanks. They are like the Zulus, whom even dum-dum bullets couldn't stop. Summarizing the culls, ornithologist Dominic Cerventi commented in the way that the media at the time covered the operation. The machine gunner's dream of point-blank fire into serried masses of emus was soon dissipated. The emu command had evidently ordered guerrilla tactics, and its unwieldy army soon split up into innumerable small units, which made the use of military equipment uneconomic. A crestfallen field force therefore withdrew from the combat area after about a month. Again, this was just three soldiers and two machine guns. It wasn't the entirety of the 6th Heavy Battery. With the media reporting the apparent failure of containing the emus and the recall of military forces, the farmers once again asked for support, even go so far as to asking ludicrous requests such as the use of field artillery and aircraft to assist them in the cull. And understandably, these requests were ignored on sight. But it didn't stop the requests. As the emus continued to plague the farmers and the hot weather and drought continued, this enticed the birds closer into agricultural centres and the boundary fences that had been erected by some farmers had either not been completed or weren't sufficient to keep them at bay. The Honourable James Mitchell, the Premier of Western Australia, lent his strong support for a renewal of military assistance. This coincided with the official military report of the operation that cited that 300 emus had been culled. This convinced Senator Pierce on the 12th of November 1932 to approve the resumption of the military's involvement. He defended his stance in federal parliament, explaining that the soldiers were necessary to combat the serious agricultural threat of the large emu population. This time, however, the military agreed to supply arms to the West Australian government on the condition that the government was required to provide men-at-arms qualified to operate them. When these men failed to manifest, Meredith and his gunners were once again deployed to support the farmers. This time around, however, they appeared to have more success, with approximately 100 emus killed per week between the 13th of November and the 2nd of December. When Meredith was recalled on December 10, he proclaimed to have killed 986 birds using 9,860 rounds of ammunition, a rate of about 10 rounds per each confirmed kill, along with approximately 2,500 birds that had died of wounds. The main reason for this damage-absorbing capacity is the overall thickness of the plumage of what soldiers in the Great War fondly called kangaroo feathers, and the overall resilience of the hide itself, which meant that unless a direct hit was scored to a critical area such as the head or underbelly of the emu, the bird could continue to function for several days before succumbing to blood loss. In assessing the success of the cull, an article in the Coolgardie Miner on the 23rd of August 1935 reported that although the use of machine guns had been criticised in many quarters, the method proved effective and saved what remained of the wheat. One thing that modern memeists ignore is that these operations weren't a declared war, but the opening stages of an animal management program that did eventually result in the farmers gaining the upper hand, even if the media at the time recalled with great glee about how the government had apparently approached the Emu High Command seeking conditions for an honourable surrender. These reports, however, didn't seem to affect Meredith or his career, with focus pointed solely at Senator Pierce. This allowed Meredith to return to the life of being a staff officer of artillery for the 5th Military District, as well as being the commanding officer of the 6th Heavy Battery in Fremantle. The battery at the time was responsible for manning Fort Arthur's Head and Fort Forrest on either side of the port of Fremantle and the entrance to the Swan River. Each of these batteries comprised of 2 6-inch guns on central pivot mountings. In April 1934, Meredith would travel to Sydney to sit the first counter-battery training course, which he passed, and resulted in a promotion to Lieutenant Colonel in October that year. He would remain in Western Australia as a staff officer until the 5th of September 1937, when he would return to Sydney and be assigned to the post of Commander of Coastal Defences for the 2nd Military District, which was the guns for all of New South Wales. He was also assigned to be the commanding officer of the 1st Heavy Brigade, quite a step up from his previous posting. When the new headquarters building for the 1st Heavy Brigade was opened in North Head, He was also appointed to be the first commanding officer for the School of Artillery at the rank of a temporary colonel at the same location. His rank would be confirmed as full colonel on the 2nd of November 1939, and this would be the post he would hold at the commencement of the Second World War. Much like the First World War, Meredith would hold staff positions at the onset of the conflict, though this time, these positions would be the Director of Mechanization and then the Director of Artillery at Army Headquarters from November 1939 until November 1940. And on the 1st of December 1940, he'd be posted to Queensland as Commander of Coastal Defences Northern Command, and would be formally taken on strength as part of the 8th Heavy Brigade in Brisbane. In this capacity, he routinely moved throughout Queensland for the duration of 1941, including occupying the same positions on Thursday Island in the Timor Strait that he occupied in the First World War. And this is a good point to end this episode. I'll pick up next time from the 18th of March 1942 with Meredith's appointment to be Officer Commanding of the Brisbane Covering Force and cover his involvement in the Second World War. But before I go, I'll leave you with this. The Emu War was a twofold exercise to deal with an Emu threat and to potentially convince the West Australian people from leaving the Commonwealth, and in that it failed both objectives. Even with improvements to exclusion barrier fencing and the reintroduction of a bounty system which was exploited, the Emu issue did not go away, and farmers repeatedly requested military assistance in 1934, 1943, and 1948. And while these requests were denied, eventually the military did release stockpiles of .303 ammunition to the farmers. As for secession, the military's presence did nothing to stop the referendum from succeeding, as it passed with a two-thirds majority. Though ultimately nothing ended up happening, as the Constitution of Australia has no provisions for secessionism. And just like the Emus, this issue has not gone away, with as recently as 2021, during the global pandemic, West Australia closed its borders to the rest of the country, and there have been rumours and rumblings about once again trying to leave the Commonwealth. Thanks for listening to the I Was Only Doing My Job podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was written, produced, and audio engineered by me, Ross Manuel, with additional research done by Laurie Favell. I'd really appreciate it, and it would help out the show, if you took some time to share this with a friend, or leave a review on Spotify, or Google Podcasts, or iTunes, or anywhere that you listen to podcasts, as it really helps other people find the show. If you want to know more about today's episode, with photos, show notes, and transcripts, head to www.thedocnetwork.net, and follow the show on IWODMJ on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Don't worry, there's a link in the show notes. If you want to follow me for history-related hijinks and other nerdery, you can follow me on practically everything at Doc Winters. Once again, thanks for listening and catch you next time. Bye!